He didn't need to explain. He simply slammed the door shut behind him. Irka's head sunk into her hands at the thought of what it all meant. The child would be interviewed. It was almost certain that the little girl would betray her unwittingly by speaking some word or another in Yiddish. She was a child. She couldn't possibly know better. Irka lay awake on the hard cell bed all that night thinking about just one thing. Disaster was coming. How was she going to get a message to Irena? When a young boy thrust the scribbled message toward her and slipped off quickly, Irena knew it was bad news. Vladka had heard about some trouble at the clinic. For days, as the court date loomed, the women in the office network racked their brains to come up with some way to save Irka from a prison sentence that was beginning to look increasingly certain. It wasn't just that prison was a brutal place. Convicted felons were fodder for the concentration camps. At last, Irena had to admit defeat. There was only one solution that she could see, and it was one that would endanger all of them. Irena and her contacts at the orphanage would have to take the indignant physician into their confidence as their newest unwitting conspirator. The orphanage's director was enlisted to explain to the doctor that Irka was not the one who had brutalized this child. It was the ghetto. The doctor, aghast, immediately agreed to drop the charges, and the courageous director ran interference with the police, blithely offering false testimony. With an apologetic shrug, she explained that, anyhow, the evidence had gone missing. The child's real mother had come to fetch the toddler, and who knew where they had gone? Home somewhere, surely. The ruse worked, because what else could the police do, really? But Irena knew this was a lose-lose proposition. It all looked very suspicious, and it created a good deal of talk and attention. Talk and attention were dangerous. Now Irena had one more unwitting conspirator to manage and a high-risk operation that was perilously close to being an open secret. They couldn't go on like this. She needed to find a safer means of transferring children to city orphanages. The transfers had to happen higher up the chain. It also had to happen urgently. A new fear was taking grip inside the ghetto. On her visits to see Alla on Smocha Street, Alla told her now of the terrible rumors reaching her contacts in the underground. Whispered reports were spreading in Warsaw with news of death in the east. In January, a 30-year-old Jewish man named Shlomo Berviner, who had escaped a camp at a place called Helmino, arrived in the city with terrifying stories. He told of how thousands were murdered in the forest, gassed together in long containers, and his listeners wept to hear him bear witness to the agonized screams of fathers made to piss on the open graves of their families, and then made to lie down among them to be executed in a hail of gunfire. But there were whispers, too, whispers that soon the Germans would round up all the children under the age of 12 and take them to a special camp, a city of children. Many in the Jewish quarter could not believe these tales were anything except crazy rumors. Those who did believe them, young men like Adam, began talking about armed Jewish resistance, and families started making immediate plans to get their sons and daughters out of the district. It was no coincidence that, by the spring of 1942, the number of children that Irena and her conspirators were smuggling out of the ghetto was exploding. Irena knew she would have to bring still more people into the secret. The Father Baudouin Children's Home was just one of the social welfare institutions and orphanages she was using to place children. But the operation at the home needed to be streamlined and expanded. She would also need to find other ways to place children in foster families through other underground connections. One person had the power to make this happen. The social welfare administrator, Jan Dobrzynski, the man whose politics Irena questioned. Jan Dobrzynski had balked at the danger before and returned dozens of children to the ghetto. and how could she trust a man with politics so different from her own? A man with anti-Semitic feelings. Yaga tried to remind Irina that she was wrong in her judgment of Jan. He was guided by his Catholic faith, and he did not lack a moral compass, even if he and Irina could not agree on which direction true north rested. Jan was as committed as any of them to the underground Polish state that they were all building. Yaga's face said to Irina that she was being narrow-minded and stubborn. "We need his help," Yaga told her gently. Still, Irina resisted. Something else was nagging at Irina. What to do about the lists that they were keeping? Yaga understood the problem. She too was worried. Only Irina and her closest conspirators ever knew the real names of these children whose identities were disappearing. Only Irina knew everything. What if something happened to her? Would anyone ever be able to find the children who were already being hidden under false names far across the city? What if? Irina would have to think up some solution. Chapter 7. Road to Treblinka, Warsaw, July 1942. Since June 1941, some Jewish and Polish prisoners had been working in a labor camp in a small village near the Bug River, less than 70 miles northeast of Warsaw. A few miles away was the railway junction at Małkinia, and in the winter of 1942, the prisoners there worked in the gravel pits surrounded by forests. In April 1942, the prisoners had been set to work on a new construction project. There was a branch spur of rail line built from Małkinia Junction, just a little zigzag of a track, and long trenches were dug out. Workers from nearby villages were brought in to quickly set up barracks. The guards overseeing the camp were cruel and executed daily a couple of dozen Jewish workers. The field was covered with the dead, left for the dogs in the evening. On June 15, 1942, the new project was at last completed, a camp for Jews. Its centerpiece was a long brick and concrete building surrounded by barbed wire. "The SS men," recalled Jan Sulkowski, a Polish prisoner made to work on the building, "said it was to be a bath. A specialist from Berlin came to put tiles inside, and he told me that he had already built such chambers elsewhere. It looked clean and inviting. There were cloakrooms for undressing, with hooks for clothing and storerooms, and a cashier's post for storing valuables, and piles of soap and towels. Tickets would be required of everyone entering the baths, and the price would be 20 zlotys. Later there would be a Red Cross camp infirmary, with a bright white and red banner, where those too infirm or troublesome to make the walk to the baths could receive special, faster treatment. The make-believe train depot, with the posted times of imaginary arrivals and departures, would only be built months later, once word of the terrible truth had made its way back to Warsaw. On July 23, 1942, when it received its first Jews from the ghetto, there was simply a railway platform to greet arrivals at the death camp in Treblinka, and a flag that waved over the roof when the chambers were running. There was a sign on the platform in German and Polish. "Jews of Warsaw, for your attention. You are in a transit camp from which you will be sent to a labor camp. As a safeguard against epidemics, you must immediately hand over your clothing and parcels for disinfection. Gold, silver, foreign currency, and jewelry must be placed with the cashier in exchange for a receipt. These will be returned to you at a later time upon presentation of the receipt. For bodily washing before continuing with the journey, all arrivals must attend the bathhouse." In time, an orchestra would play Yiddish songs and cheerful camp marches to cover the sound of barking dogs and the screaming. Henia Koppel was 22 in the summer of 1942. She lived in the ghetto with her husband, Yosel, who was a rich banker and many years older. Her father, Aaron Rockman, a successful businessman, lived not far away with Henya's family, and for a time the combined wealth of the two families offered some protection, even in the ghetto. With considerable foresight, Yosel stashed away much of their large fortune in a numbered account in Switzerland, and enough was still hidden in banknotes secreted underneath the floorboards or tucked deep inside a mattress somewhere that there was money that summer to buy Henya one of the coveted German work permits. The permit allowed her to work as slave labor at the Walter Tubman's ghetto factory as a seamstress. Working for the Germans brought a certain measure of safety. Soon mass resettlements to the labor camps were coming. There had been warnings and cryptic announcements. The ghetto had been holding its collective breath since at least April. The Germans didn't so readily ship off to the labor camps outside Warsaw people who were already working in the city, so work papers were precious. By July, permits were selling for upward of 5,000 zlotys, something approaching the modern equivalent of $15,000. They cost about the same as another increasingly desirable commodity that summer, cyanide capsules. There was one terrible flaw in the plan to protect Henya with a work permit. The Tubman's factory didn't let mothers bring children with them during their crushingly long hours. Elspieta, baby Bieta, was 6 months old and breastfeeding. So the family turned to their friend, Eva Rechtman. Elspieta's older cousin was already safely in hiding on the Aryan side, thanks to Eva's intervention and the raw courage of Irena. Irena had smuggled Bieta's cousin across the checkpoints. When Irena Sendler knocked on the family's door, she knew her proposal was audacious. But she also knew that for the Koppel family, and for all the families in the ghetto, the options were disappearing quickly. Would Henya and Yosel let her try to save their baby? Saving the infant was also the only lifeline Yosel knew for Henya. His greatest strength of character was a clear-sighted understanding. Always families asked Irena the same agonizing question. What guarantee can you give of our baby's safety? Yosel Koppel asked it now of her, earnestly and urgently. Irena could only answer these anxious worries honestly. I can promise you nothing except that I will risk my life today trying, she told them. She could not even promise that she and Bieta would make it out alive from the ghetto that day out. Death was waiting for them both if they were discovered at the checkpoint. They might be shot at random on the doorstep while leaving, for that matter. People were shot every day in the ghetto, for the most trivial reasons. Yosel sighed and nodded. He knew that this was true. It didn't make the family's decision any easier, but the ghetto was already a death sentence for a baby. Henya and Yosel agreed to give their daughter to this small, determined stranger. Irena witnessed scenes like this over and over, and these were the moments that left her sleepless when she woke from dreams of it later. The nightmares came and went, and Adam held her close, when she told him afterward and whispered to her that she was just getting worn out and tired. Now she looked on as Henya held the sleeping baby close to her chest, breathing in the scent of her infant, and Irena saw a face wet with tears that did not stop coming. There was no choice now but to act quickly. Soon the family would not be able to finish what they had started. Some days Irena didn't know if she would be able to either. Irena reached out and began to take the infant. Henya's green eyes pleaded with Irena. The tears welled up in Irena's eyes, and the two women gazed at each other for a moment. Henya rocked Bieta softly, and then just a little bit more firmly. The infant kept on sleeping. It was good. Irena set her hand for a moment on the small chest, just to make sure her breath wasn't too shallow, then nodded. The tranquilizer was working. Henya Koppel let go of her baby. Irena promised again. Yes, she would send them word to let them know that they had made it out safely. Yes, she assured Henya, she would make sure, no matter what, that the silver baby spoon engraved with the child's birth date went everywhere with Elzbieta. But now Irena and the young builder assisting her on this mission, Henrik, the stepson of one of her collaborators, had to act quickly. They were about to risk all their lives to smuggle the 6-month-old Elzbieta out of the ghetto. Irena laid the baby into a wooden toolbox and tucked the blanket around her firmly, making sure they didn't block the little girl's air passages. Irena shut the lid, and the hasp clicked into place. On the street, Henrik deftly tucked the box among the piles of bricks in the back of a flatbed truck and gave Irena a quick, tense smile. His contractor's work pass let him come in and out of the ghetto, and he was yet another new addition to Irena's network. Irena pulled herself up into the passenger seat, and the truck lurched into motion as Henrik manipulated the old clutch. Irena turned sharply, praying that none of the bricks had shifted or fallen. They drove in silence toward Nalevki Street, past the closed bakeries and rusted street signs, past the narrow apartment buildings and past the ragged and starving people who littered the street corners of the busy avenue. When they reached the Nalevki Street gate, Irena groaned. Damn. She wanted this part to be over, but there was a long line this afternoon. Crossing the checkpoint was the most dangerous part of any day. Minutes ticked by, and the waiting was agony. Irena's hands were cold with sweat and slippery as she fingered the door handle. As if they could escape now anyhow, she reminded herself. There was no turning back from the checkpoint. At last a soldier gestured them forward, and Henrik handed over their ghetto passes with cool self-possession that impressed Irena. The guard looked hard at Irena, then at Henrik. "What's in the back?" His eyes narrowed, and this time Henrik stumbled with the answers. So they wouldn't make it out of the ghetto today alive after all. It was always a possibility. Henrik stepped slowly from the truck and moved as he was ordered. Irena waited. From the back now she could hear the sounds of the flaps opening and shutting. The soldier knocked his heavy boots against the bricks and poked under the canvases and in corners. Irena held her breath. And then, a moment later, Henrik was climbing back in beside her, and the guards waved them through the gates to freedom. On the Aryan side, Irena grasped Henrik's arm in relief as the truck slowed at a street corner. "Are you fine the rest of the way alone, Henrik? It will look better." Henrik nodded. Irena slid from the seat and waved to Henrik as the truck moved on, and then she turned her footsteps in the other direction. All Henrik had to do from there was take the baby home in the toolbox to his stepmother. Irena knew that, if anyone were being watched, she herself was the greatest danger to this mission. Henrik's stepmother, a middle-aged midwife named Stanislava Busold, was one of Irena's trusted emergency room operatives, one of the liaisons who worked closely in the medical underground with Alla Golamp-Grinberg and Helena Sheshko. Irena called places like this, somewhat bureaucratically, her protective readiness distribution points, and they were risky operations. In their first hours and days outside the ghetto, someone had to clean the smuggled children, feed them, and get them medical care, which they often needed urgently after months of starvation. If they had, quote, bad looks, there would be makeovers to lighten their hair color, and circumcised little Jewish boys were often transformed into little Polish girls for their own protection. If the children were old enough, the emergency room guardians would also teach them Catholic prayers and how to speak Polish. Catechism drills were a favorite German test to catch out Jews, and knowing one's childhood prayers by heart was the most basic tool of wartime survival. In their first weeks on the Aryan side, the children had to learn how to erase any hint of being Jewish. Smuggling children out in toolboxes was a high-risk operation, and Irena was searching feverishly in 1942 for better options. Options that would let them move not just one child, but dozens. It became necessary to take the children to the Aryan side, that spring, Irena said bluntly, because it was hell inside the ghetto. Under Hitler's and Himmler's orders, children were dying on the streets with the consent of the entire world. And Irena did what she always did when she was troubled for answers. She turned to her friends and to Dr. Radlinska. Helena Radlinska had not left the convent on Gersha Street since the autumn of 1939, but there was nothing reclusive about the way the old professor was living. Her small rooms were at the heart of a daring salon where the underground gathered. When Irena tapped on the small doorway now, she was met with people coming and going. Some were students clutching notebooks, part of the professor's secret classroom. Others had faces her age. A few she recognized from bygone days at the Polish Free University. Sometime in the winter of 1941-42, three of those faces belonged to her old college friends Stanislav Papuzinski, his partner Zofia Wedrychowska, and their sister-in-law Izabela Kuszkowska, Iza. Together, the professor's three former students had formed a daring group, running another of the resistance cells that Dr. Radlinska was coordinating from her convent offices. By the spring of 1942, Dr. Radlinska was at the hub of several networks helping to save Jewish children. For months, Iza had been in charge of a smuggling operation, ferrying food and medicine into the ghetto through the basement corridors of the courthouse on Leszno Street. Now, Stanislav, Zofia, and Iza were all about to give Irena one part of the solution that she so desperately needed. Leszno Street straddled the ghetto, and there were doors that opened in both directions if one could just get past the checkpoints on the main floors. If Iza and a helpful janitor in the building could get supplies in, they could surely take children out in the other direction, they reasoned, as long as Irena could find a place to hide them safely. And for that, Irena had an entire secret social welfare network. Dozens of school-aged children left the ghetto that spring, guided through the courthouse. But that wasn't the only route that Irena used now. Leon Szeszko, whose wife Helena was one of Irena's team nurses and most dedicated collaborators, hit upon another daring idea. Leon worked in the civil transportation office, and every day he knew of a streetcar on the Muranov line that ran in and out of the ghetto. Overnight, empty cars were parked in the grubby depot on the northern edge of the ghetto. Who would notice a forgotten package or a weathered old bag tucked under a seat on the first quiet run of the morning? Irena instantly saw the possibilities there, too. Sleeping babies fit snugly inside briefcases. Someone would have to brave the streets of the ghetto in the hours before dawn to make the drop-off in the empty rail yard, of course. Someone with rare permission to travel after curfew. It was permission given only to a handful of people in the Jewish quarter, but by great fortune, the chief nurse in the ghetto, a la Golam Grinberg, had it. And she also had the experience needed to administer just the right dose of sedative to a tiny body. Soon, when the Muranov streetcar rattled empty down the tracks at daybreak, unnoticed packages rattled southward along with them, waved on unseen by guards at the barbed wire checkpoints. At the first stop on the Aryan side, Irena climbed aboard swiftly, just another city resident anxious to get on with her morning. Beneath her feet, a bag rested, quietly waiting. She rode a long way, quietly looking out the window, until the last passenger who had seen her board alighted. Then Irena would smooth her hair and gather up her packages. And there were other ways, too. There was another small underground cell that had gathered around the All Saints Catholic Church that straddled the boundary of the ghetto. The boundary followed the curves and turns of Tvarda Street, and the All Saints Church had doors that faced in both directions. Dr. Radlinska's cousin, Dr. Ludwig Hirschfeld, worked there in secret with Alla's contacts to smuggle medical supplies through tunnels dug out in the church's crypts and basements. And Irena herself still slipped off to the meetings of the underground press that took place in the old rectory potting shed, where her friend, the attorney Yusef Zisman, proposed another route that Irina could use to save children. In hushed tones, Yusef explained how the junior priest, Father Charnetsky, was with them in the resistance. The senior priest, Father Marcelli Godlevsky, he said, was willing to provide new birth certificates. Any child with, quote, good looks, who would learn prayers well enough and was a fearless actor, could walk out the front door on the Aryan side. For months, Alla had been on the front lines, helping Irena and her co-workers transport children to the Aryan side. As chief nurse of the ghetto hospitals, and as a Judenrat liaison with the Jewish Society for the Protection of Health, Alla still had a ghetto pass. For months she had been using the pass to guide children out of the Jewish quarter, delivering them to the apartment of another new conspirator in Irena's office network, a fellow social worker named Rusha Zhavadska. The orphaned toddler in Alla's charge, Dalia, was three, and Alla had already spirited Dalia to safety, passing her into the steady hands of Irena and her network. But Alla's daughter, Rami, was six, and she could not bear to part with her little girl. So she had waited. Alla now made an agonizing decision. She knew she couldn't wait any longer. What worried Alla in the spring of 1942, as she watched the noose that was the ghetto tighten around them, was how much longer ghetto passes would be permitted. Rumors swirled through the ghetto of coming deportations. Irena begged Alla to act quickly to save both herself and Rami. "I will find a place for you both, Alla." Alla shook her head sadly. Alla wasn't leaving either, but she agreed at last to part with her daughter. One day in 1942, Rami does not remember the month or what gate they passed through on their way out of the ghetto. Alla took Rami with her to visit Rusha. It wasn't the first time they had gone there together, and so at first nothing seemed unusual. For a long while, Alla and Rusha talked in quiet voices, and then when it was time to go, her mother kissed her gently and shut the door of the apartment behind her. "One day she left me with Rusha," Rami says simply. "She visited me once after. Then I never again saw her." At first, Irena shuttled Alla's little girl from one orphanage to another, but Rami was one of the difficult children to place. She did not look like what a German thought of a typical Polish child. Rusha and Irena finally found a foster family for the little girl, in the home of two Polish aristocrats and underground activists, Jadwiga and Janusz Strawecka, who had a daughter of their own named Elzbieta. But Rami wanted her mother. The children numbered in the hundreds, and getting children out of the ghetto was not the hardest part of this operation. Placing them safely on the Aryan side was soon where Irena was running into logistical complications. Irena had run out of other options. She needed Jan Dobroczynski's assistance. She and Jan were not natural political allies, and she had not forgotten their fierce argument about the fate of those 32 street children. But by now the conspirators numbered as many as 25 people on the Aryan side of the city, and at least as many again inside the ghetto. 10 of her Polish collaborators, all 4 of the original conspirators included, were actively smuggling children out of the ghetto, along with Alla, Helena, Iza, and some of the teenage Jewish girls in Alla's youth circle. The growing numbers were unmanageable without someone higher up in the orphanage division helping with placements and paperwork. Jaga was sure that Jan would not disappoint them this time. Irena at last took Jan Dobroczynski into her secret. Irena called together a meeting of women in his division, and a group of a half dozen of them, Irena and Jaga at the lead, marched into Jan's office together. "One day, my staff, namely social workers in the department, came to me about this matter," Jan explained. "That whole group had for some time, of their own volition, been running operations extracting Jewish children from the ghetto and placing them into one or another of the section's care centers on the basis of falsified records and interviews, after arranging the entire matter directly with the heads of the different centers. However, possibilities there had now been exhausted, and Jan did not refuse them. By the spring of 1942, to refuse to help the resistance was its own kind of danger. Those who collaborated with the Germans were already facing justice in secret Polish courts, which brought down its own death sentences. Jan didn't agree for that reason, though. He was already in the Polish resistance, on the political right, and no one questioned his patriotism. Jan agreed because his faith and his conscience nagged at him. He remembered the children he had returned to the ghetto, too, and it had troubled him afterward. Jan freely acknowledged in the years that followed that his involvement in the office network was nothing compared to the risks Irena and her friends were taking. He did what Irena asked of him. "But I did not look for these children. I did not transport them. I did not create the false papers," he admitted. What Jan could do, Irena explained, was use his contacts to come to an understanding with the nuns at the Father Bauduin Children's Home and at institutions across Poland about the transfer of Jewish orphans. And Jan agreed that he would make this happen. "Very quickly," Irena reported, Jan followed through on the promise, reaching out to his contacts in the resistance to find reliable partners. "Jan Dobraczynski came to an understanding with the underground," she explained, "which agreed to guide the Jewish children to centers. With the nuns who ran the homes, Jan made another standing arrangement. Anytime Irena needed to transfer a Jewish child secretly, he would personally sign the request." "Normally," Jaga explained, "the section manager would not sign these papers. Jan's signature was a code, a signal that we were dealing with a child, as we said then, requiring special care and attention." From then on, Ala was in contact with Jan Dobraczynski nearly constantly as Irena's ghetto liaison. It was increasingly Ala who coordinated advanced logistics with the Catholic charities when a ghetto child needed to be saved. Where Bieta Koppel would end up, no one yet knew for certain, but successes like this meant everything to Irena. For the moment, the infant would stay hidden in the home of Stanisława Busold, who would have to find some story to explain to nosy Folkdeutsche neighbors how a woman in her late 50s happened to suddenly have a crying 6-month-old baby at home. Soon, in the normal course of things, Bieta would move on from the emergency room to permanent shelter. When she did, only Irena would know where she was going, and that Henia and Josel Koppel were her parents. It was a chain of knowing as fragile as Irena's life and the flimsy bits of tissue paper on which that truth was written, but it was for Bieta's safety. Irena added one more name to the list of children. "What we had on those lists," Irena revealed in her typical matter-of-fact fashion, "was the real first and last name of the child, based on their birth certificate, as well as their current address. This data was necessary in order to be able to provide them with money, clothing, medicine, and also so that we could find them after the war." On that scrap of paper, next to the entry, Elżbieta Koppel, was penciled in the name of her new identity, Stefcha Rumkowski. A few days after baby Bieta was taken across the ghetto walls to safety, a man sat in the darkness of the ghetto thinking about the fate of Warsaw's Jewish children. Dr. Janusz Korczak was awake in a small room at number 16 Siena Street, writing. He had been gripped all day with a grim sense of foreboding. The doctor was in his early 60s, and the following day, July 22, 1942, was his birthday. It had been a good life and a long one, although the last few years had been a terrible struggle. He had already been in and out of prison during the occupation for small acts of defiance against the Germans. His refusal to wear the armband with the Star of David had very nearly been fatal. Dr. Korczak had no illusions about the ghetto or about what his time in prison had cost him. He could tell by looking in the mirror that it had wasted him. He was a skinny old man now, bald and stooped, and he was tired. In another room, perhaps Stefania was sleeping already. He and Stefania Vilchinska, one of the other orphanage directors, had been partners, making a life together for each other and hundreds of children in their schools and orphanages for years. And it had been a strange half-marriage. Stefania was in love with the doctor. Everyone could see it but Janusz Korczak. All he could see was the children. The doctor couldn't sleep. Turning to his journal, he poured out his thoughts and longings onto the paper. "It is a difficult thing," he wrote, "to be born and to learn to live. What remains for me is a much easier task, to die. I do not know what I would say to the children as a farewell. I would want to say so much. It is 10 o'clock. Shots. 2. Several. 2. 1. Several. Perhaps my window is poorly darkened right now, but I will not interrupt my writing. The opposite. My thoughts take flight. A single shot." The doctor's sense of doom was sadly merited. In the morning, the resettlements that the inhabitants of the ghetto had been awaiting anxiously for months started. There had been no warning. As Janusz Korczak sat awake in the small hours thinking, those outside the ghetto walls might have seen something ominous and fearful. Dozens of armed men surrounding the area. In darkness, the ghetto was sealed, and soldiers crept to stations on the nearby rooftops and at the checkpoints, prepared to shoot down any residents bent on escaping. By breakfast, the leader of the Judenrat, a man called Adam Cherniakov, had his orders. Großaktion Warsaw had started. The removal of Jews from the city, he was informed, was even now beginning. Cherniakov wrote in his diary that day, "We are told that all the Jews will be deported to the east. By 4 p.m. today a contingent of 6,000 people must be provided, and this, at the minimum, will be the daily quota." He was made personally responsible for ensuring that the Jewish police met the quota of fellow Jews boarding the trains that day at the Umschlagplatz, the loading platform for the railcars. Any ghetto resident who worked for the Jewish police, who was a member of the Judenrat, or who was capable of significant labor in Warsaw was exempt from the resettlement orders. The price that week of German-issued work permits doubled again, and the ghetto was instantly divided into fortunate and unfortunate. Those categorically not able to work, and thus destined for the rail cars, included the sick, the half-starved, the elderly, and all the ghetto's children. Irina rushed to the ghetto the instant the word of the deportations reached her. She needed to see Adam. She needed to know that he was safe, otherwise this panic in her gut would cripple her. Adam knew that she would be frantic, and when she made her way to the youth center, he was waiting to reassure her. He had not been caught up in the first day's roundups, and he wasn't likely to be caught up in the next day's roundups either, he told Irina. The word in the ghetto was that only the old and the very young, and those who were not capable of working, would be taken. Adam was just the kind of person who might flex an arm jokingly, with a tired smile, in the kind of reassuring, silent gesture that said, "See, I'm young and tough." Adam could always make Irina smile. For now, Adam had a job, and a job meant safety. Rachela, Eva, Yusuf, and Alla were safe too then. They all had jobs. Irina tried to tell herself that none of them were in immediate danger. But both Adam and Irina knew already that it wasn't quite so simple. The youth center was in chaos, and there were far fewer young people than normal. Parents were keeping their children close as the word spread throughout the Jewish quarter, and the fear and uncertainty on the streets were palpable. Those who were rounded up most quickly were the orphans and the street children, who had no one to turn to. Adam's work kept him safe, but there was a voice in Irina's head that kept repeating an awful question. When the children were deported, there would be no need for youth centers. Then what would happen? On July 23rd, the second day of the action, the Judenrat leader, faced with delivering a new order for 10,000 bodies and knowing it meant aiding in the murder of infants and toddlers, committed suicide in a long-overdue crisis of conscience by swallowing cyanide in his office. The Germans just made other prominent Jews and the Jewish police responsible for delivering the quotas. At first, naturally, there were few volunteers for these resettlements. The scenes playing out on the streets were vicious, and most residents now preferred to stay out of sight in their apartments. When quota numbers started coming up short, police cordoned off streets, emptied buildings, and marched stricken residents under armed guard to the depot. Soon the goose steps of the Jewish police echoed through the streets of the ghetto each morning starting at 8 a.m. for the roundups. To argue or resist meant instant sidewalk execution. At first, having work papers sometimes mattered. Lucky residents at the house roundups waved them like a magic talisman. They had cost a family's last savings to buy them at astronomical prices. Already, though, there was a growing pressure to make up the number of bodies at any cost, and all that really mattered were the German quotas. On the street, the selections were made. To one side went those selected as fit for work gangs or slave labor in the German munitions factories. To the other stood those destined that day for resettlement to Treblinka. One member of the Polish underground who witnessed the roundups that first day, a man who knew Irena, wrote, "Wednesday, July 22nd, 1942. So this is the end of the ghetto that has been fighting desperately to stay alive for 2 years. Jewish police have been hunting humans since noon. Crowds are led to the connection track in the square of Stavsky Street. When a car was full, it was wired shut with barbed wire. It is raining, and the sight of this agony is unbearable." Irena, with her epidemic control pass, was still going in and out of the ghetto several times a day, along with Irka, Jaga, Jadwiga, and Helena. The German strategy was to keep up the illusion for as long as possible that this was the resettlement of the unproductive sectors of the ghetto population. Medical care and epidemic control was part of that fiction. Because of their disease control passes, they were among the relatively few Polish residents of Warsaw who were first-hand witnesses to the coming horror, and they would all risk their lives trying to stop it. Chapter 8. The Good Fairy of the Umschlagplatz. Warsaw, July to August, 1942. Getting children out of the ghetto now took on a terrible urgency. Irene was desperate in the first hours of the deportations to get in touch with her friend and conspirator, Alla Goam Grinberg. All that first afternoon she couldn't find her anywhere. Alla wasn't at her youth center offices. Looking around the quiet room and the tidy circle of chairs, Irene could still remember sitting there with Alla, listening to Dr. Landau's typhus lectures. Irene tried to find Alla at home on Smocha Street, just a few doors down from the youth center. She wasn't there either. The second morning in the ghetto, Irene was growing frantic with worry. Desperate, Irene tried looking for her at the medical clinics in the ghetto, where Alla was still the chief nurse for the Jewish quarter. Someone told her at last that Alla was at the Umschlagplatz already. Irene's heart sank. She would go to the Umschlagplatz. She had to save Alla. At the loading area, the barbed wire and misery of the pulsing crowds assaulted Irene's senses and all her sensibilities. Hot tears started to her eyes, and she felt like gagging. Thousands of bodies pressed mercilessly together in the summer heat. The whiff of excrement and sweat and terror was already powerful. There were no facilities, no waiting rooms. There was just this fetid square, baking in the sun, and endless fear and misery. She stared among the crowd, craning her neck. She would never find Alla. But she had to. There was a sudden commotion somewhere to the right, and a flash of white. Standing on her tiptoes in the crowd, Irene searched again. Somewhere she caught a glimpse of some black frizzy hair that she was sure she recognized. It disappeared among the jostling masses. Then, at last, she spotted Alla, just outside the wire boundary, at the edge of the Umschlagplatz. A makeshift medical clinic had appeared from nowhere within hours of the deportations. Around it buzzed nurses and doctors. Alla, soft-spoken, gentle Alla, with her poet's soul but fighter's spirit. Irena saw instantly that Alla was already emerging that morning as one of the greatest heroines in the ghetto. She was the lead conspirator in a spectacular rescue mission, a ruse played out with riveting bravado right under the noses of the Germans. It hadn't begun as a ruse, Alla explained to her friend quickly, but in the end one had to fight fire with fire. When the word of the resettlements whipped through the ghetto the day before, Alla told Irena how she had rushed to the hospital. Jewish doctors and nurses, friends and colleagues, milled about anxiously. Perhaps, the hospital staff tried to reassure themselves, these were in fact only resettlements. Alla, with her contacts in the underground, knew better. She had heard the stories about Helmino and believed the broken man who told them. But the destination hardly mattered now. To send those who were frail or delirious on a hard journey to the east was tantamount to a death sentence, wherever the journey ended. A friend caught her arm as she was rushing past. Alla, there has to be a medical clinic at the train depot. Think of all those people. Alla turned to him. Nahum Remba was right. Alla nodded. Nahum Remba was not a doctor. He was a 32-year-old clerk in the Judenrat offices who managed funding and paperwork for her clinics. And, like Alla and Arek, he and his wife, Henya Remba, were activists in the Jewish resistance. Nahum was a tall, dark-haired man, and something of a jokester, always making wry cracks that had people laughing. Alla liked his dry sense of humor and stubborn optimism. But there wasn't much to laugh about in the ghetto that morning. Nahum had a crazy idea. Would Alla join him? What if they rounded up some real doctors and nurses and set up a medical sanitation point and dispensary on the outside corner of the Umschlagplatz Plaza? It would require, he warned her, some of her brave and brilliant acting. Nahum and Alla both came from famous and tightly knit theatrical families where inside jokes were common. Nahum couldn't help it. Alla rolled her eyes and instantly agreed to help him. So they did it. Alla and Nahum pretended that they had permission to set up a clinic. They requisitioned an area near the loading docks, a space bordered by barbed wire, and opened for some urgent medical business. They would identify anyone too weak or too young to travel and insist on treatment and sometimes a hospital transfer. They would also find a way to save important members of the Jewish resistance, which included Arek, who was somewhere out in the forests with the partisans. Very soon a skinny 20-year-old named Marek Edelman, the co-leader of a paramilitary group known as the Jewish Combat Organization, Żydowska Organizacja Bojowa, or ZOB, joined their network at the square at their official resistance liaison. Marek had jet-black hair and a boyish air, but inside the ghetto he was already emerging as one of the two or three most important people in the ghetto resistance movement. One day, he would lead the ghetto Jews in a dramatic uprising. But in the summer of 1942, at Alla's Umschlagplatz clinic, Marek was charged with coordinating the transfers between the trackside refuge and the ghetto hospital. Marek Edelman's ties to the underground meant he had no illusions about where these boxcars were headed. It started out as a project to save the weakest and most vulnerable and to liberate the ghetto's most dedicated activists. It quickly became a race to save anyone possible. What their rescue brigade accomplished was astonishing. Nahum Remba played his part to the hilt. He was acting for his life and the lives of others. He convinced the Germans that he was the chief doctor in the ghetto, and Alla was the chief nurse. They played along with the German ruse that these were simply resettlements. To keep up the facade, smug Germans humored these duped and deluded Jewish doctors and nurses. Maintaining order during the liquidations was the chief objective for the occupiers, and a few Jews, more or less now, would not matter. Within days, Nahum Remba was the most famous person at the Umschlagplatz, and his authority as the chief doctor of the ghetto, with the aid of some well-placed bribes and a white doctor's coat, went unchallenged even by the Germans. He and Alla insisted that those who were too ill or too young to make a train voyage be released to them and saved from the trains. They commandeered a hospital ambulance and started loading up adults and children. Marek Edelman moved among the milling crowd, his pockets stuffed with documents signed by Alla certifying that the fortunate recipient of those papers was too sick to travel. The brigade could not save everyone. That much was obvious. Out of the 300,000 people deported from the railway square that summer and into the autumn, this small group saved, in the brief three-week window that it existed, a mere 200 or 300 of their neighbors. But those were hundreds of lives that mattered. They were lives that echo still in that exponential way of generations. Among those they saved were all the children from the orphanage at number 27 Tvarda Street, whom the Germans had marked for deportation to Treblinka. They saved a resistance fighter named Edwin Weiss. And they saved an old friend, Jonas Turkov, the Jewish actor who knew well both Alla's cousin, Vera Gran, and Irene Sendler. Alla personally pulled from the crowd as well one of Jonas's younger sisters. The day that he was saved, Jonas could only remember afterward being astonished by Nahum Remba's raw courage. At the Umschlagplatz, Jonas was caught up in the crush as residents pushed and surged inside the barbed wire corrals on the brink of panic. In their midst, Nahum appeared with a placid smile on his face, exuding confidence and calm. Jonas knew that anyone else who approached a German in this manner would have been shot instantly. He and the others had seen it happen. On the loading docks, a bullet was the answer to a Jewish question. But Nahum didn't ask questions so much as he gave orders. "This one is too sick to make the difficult journey east," he would say, pointing and shrugging good-naturedly, as if it were of no particular interest. Nahum knew the consummate Jewish wisdom of the ghetto, no fear and no sad faces. Those whom Nahum snatched from the masses were trundled off to the infirmary. Jonas was one of them. Life or death. It was cruelly random. Inside the infirmary, Alla ordered the sick patients into beds. All around Jonas, the nurses were busy putting on rolls of fresh white bandages. It seemed like a dream to Jonas. Was it possible that he was dead already? A German appeared at the door, and the pace grew frenetic. Then Jonas knew that he was indeed still in the ghetto. Jonas lay very still and tried to make himself small until the German disappeared. At last, the all-clear signal came. The doors to the clinic closed. The ambulances were rolling up to move them. Next, the patients ran a terrible gauntlet. There was no guarantee of safety, even, especially, in a clinic in the ghetto. At the door, the cool Germans and their fearsome Ukrainian lackeys made capricious inspections. A man near Jonas did not look sick enough. A rifle butt crashed down on men like this, and Jonas could hear the man's cries of agony as he was dragged to the loading platform. Alla and Nahum looked on in horror. Alla gave her nurses the only orders she could imagine. "We will have to break their legs if they look too healthy. Explain to them the choices." Anything to convince the Germans someone could not travel. The screams of agony were not acting. Alla could not spare the few remaining sedative doses on the fit. She needed those for the children. Her flowing white coat hung on her thin frame, and more than once Alla did something else bold and reckless. It was for this she saved the drugs in the dispensary. Fussy and frightened children, unable to feign disease, were gently helped to sleep in order to save them, because the guards treated the smallest infants the most harshly. Babies were dashed to the ground and swung by the heels against railway cars until their skulls burst, as their hysterical mothers wailed in anguish. So Alla tucked the littlest ones under her coat and marched them out past the sentries, cradled beneath her armpit, and walked them into the waiting ambulances, too. She and Remba had diverted an ambulance, and Alla trundled patients inside. She only had to get them as far as Irena. Alla and Nakum's wild ruse continued for weeks. Irena came to Alla each day, always asking what she and her network could possibly do to help. On the loading platform, mothers now thrust their babies at Alla, the woman everyone called the Good Fairy. For 16 hours a day, Alla and Nahum worked alongside the platform. They were a constant presence, in constant motion. And on the afternoon of August 6th, that meant that they were among the last unwilling witnesses to one of the ghetto's cruelest tragedies. On that morning, as a prelude to the complete liquidation of the little ghetto, the SS came for the children at Dr. Korchak's orphanage. Among the doctor's nearly 200 orphans were the 32 Jewish boys and girls whom Jan Dobrzynski had returned through a chink in the wall less than a year earlier. They were the boys and girls whom Irena already thought of as her children. Rumors that Dr. Korchak's orphanage was being emptied swept through the ghetto just after 9 o'clock that morning. Irena usually made her daily visits to the ghetto in the afternoons, when work was over and the loading at the Umschlagplatz was underway. That day she happened to come early, well before noon. Irena was a familiar face at the ghetto orphanage, and one of the children's favorite guests at their amateur theatricals. The children shrieked with pleasure at her small gifts and silly antics, and she stopped by to look in on her street children especially. When Irena heard the news that the children were all destined for deportation, she raced toward Siena Street, hoping somehow to get to the old doctor in time to warn or to help him. But the SS had long since arrived at the orphanage with the orders. The children were to have been taken away alone, one witness remembered, and the doctor was given 15 minutes to prepare them. Dr. Korchak steadfastly refused to leave the children. "You do not leave a sick child in the night," Dr. Korchak stated bluntly, his voice barely containing its fury. "And you do not leave children at a time like this." The German SS officer leading the procession laughed and told the professor to come along then if he wished, and good-naturedly asked a 12-year-old boy carrying a violin to play a tune. The children set off from the orphanage singing. The route to the loading platform was arduous. With children, the march across the ghetto from south to north might have taken as long as 3 or 4 hours. Irena first saw them coming at the corner of Zielazna Street, then turning into Leszna Street. It was a swelteringly hot day already, insanely hot, Irena said, and sometimes the children had to stop and rest. But as they turned the corner, they were still marching confidently. Irena understood in an instant that the doctor had kept from them any fear or knowledge of what was coming. Anxious Jewish residents stayed off the blocked streets, and Irena remembered afterward there were only a handful of pedestrians. Those who braved the streets walked quickly head down toward their destinations, willing themselves to be invisible. But that day, dozens, including Jonas Turkov, watched from windows or street corners in astounded silence as they witnessed the doctor's 3-mile walk through the ghetto with the orphans. The doctor's face was a frozen mask of hard-won self-control, and Irena knew that he was already sick and struggling. But that morning his back was straight, and he was carrying one of the weary toddlers. "Am I dreaming?" the thought floated through Irena's mind. "Is this possible? What is the possible guilt of these children?" On the empty street corner, her eyes met the doctor's for a moment. He didn't stop to greet her. He did not smile. He said nothing. The doctor just kept walking. The children marched in rows of four, neatly turned out in their best holiday clothes, and disciplined. Then Irena saw what the littlest ones were carrying. In their hands they held the dolls that